in the Division of STD Prevention at CDC, and we've heard a lot of really interesting talks looking at different aspects of chlamydia, natural history, and immunobiology. And so at the end of the day here, I'm going to try putting it all together and thinking about how we integrate basic science and epidemiologic findings to inform chlamydia control. So let's just think about what happens upon chlamydial infection. We know that infection with C. trachomatis stimulates an array of immune responses, and the main purpose of these responses is to try to get rid of the infection. Your body is trying to get rid of the chlamydial infection. We heard from Dr. Geisler that we don't know the precise duration of infection in humans. The available studies have a lot of limitations, but this clearance process may take months or even years. We do know from animal studies that an adaptive Th1 response is important for clearing the infection. And one big remaining question is this issue of the aberrant RB state that's seen in vitro, whether this occurs in vivo. So these immune responses that develop can also lead to pathogenesis and sequelae. Some components of them, we don't know which. Dr. Darvall described two main paradigms for chlamydial pathogenesis that have been proposed in the past. And these paradigms are not mutually exclusive. There may be some components of each that are at play, and the idea is to try and get a better understanding of the balance. Under the cellular paradigm, pathogenesis is primarily driven by infected epithelial cells, by the inflammatory mediators that they produce, and by the inflammatory mediators of the immune cells that they attract. Under the immunological paradigm, the adaptive T-cell responses that develop to try to clear infection are thought to have collateral damage, and this may be especially important with repeat infection. It's important to remember, though, that not all women with chlamydial infection get pathological sequelae. The risk is incompletely defined, but perhaps most women with infection do not get sequelae. So these immune responses can also lead to some protective immunity against a future infection. And Dr. Badiger went over this. We know that from animal data, there's clear evidence that partial protective immunity occurs. The human evidence is indirect, but suggests some degree of partial protective immunity in humans. But the immunity is partial at best and can be overcome on exposure, and we know that repeat infection is common. So one other consideration that I'd like to introduce that I think is important is the site of infection. We have to remember that when we're talking about pathological damage, it's the damage at the level of the tubes that we care about. Infection has to get there first. So, and Dr. Darvall went over this, infection has to go from the cervix to the fallopian tubes, and the precise time course and the factors that predict this really are unknown. May be related to the nature of the immune response at the level of the cervix, the inoculum at the cervix, and other factors such as co-infections or hormonal status. So let's step back and think, what are we trying to do with chlamydia control programs? The main goal is obviously to reduce reproductive sequelae by either treating infected women before the infection progresses or by reducing transmission in the population and thus preventing new infections in the first place. In the U.S., there are three main program activities that we can use to try and reach this goal. Most programs are based primarily on screening asymptomatic women for prevalent infection, with varying emphasis on efforts to find and treat male sex partners and also to screen women for reinfection. The effectiveness of these screening and treatment, these program activities, is dependent on the natural history of chlamydial infection. For an individual woman, the potential benefits of screening are dependent on the baseline risk of damage. So if the infection isn't treated, what is the risk that sequelae would occur? and also the benefits of averting downstream tubal damage by screening and treatment. Now, the benefits of averting downstream damage are dependent on two main things: when tubal damage occurs in the course of infection, and when the infection is detected. Now, these potential benefits need to be balanced against potential risks and harms from repeat infection. So, the first thing to consider is the risk of re-exposure. With screening, women are returned to the pool of susceptible women slightly earlier than they might have been if they hadn't been treated. And in addition, they may have a higher chance of coming into another infection, especially if little attention has been paid to partner management. Potential risk also depends on the degree to which protective immunity develops and how much it can be altered by our treatment with a screening program. And finally, an important consideration is how harmful is repeat infection, whether tissue-damaging responses are actually enhanced during a second infection or not. So the first thing I'm going to focus on is when tubal damage occurs. And remember that this incorporates the time course of ascension from the cervix to the fallopian tubes and the time course within the tubes. The bottom line is that we don't know when the timing of tubal damage is. You know, all of the available epidemiologic studies are limited by the fact that we do not know when the infection was acquired. So when we pick up a prevalent infection, and this has been mentioned several times before, we don't know if they just acquired it or they acquired it a year ago. But we can get some clues based on the basic science data that Dr. Darville presented. Depending on the mechanism of pathogenesis, it might give us some clues into timing and the programmatic implications. So if infected epithelial cells primarily drive pathology, tissue damage could occur as soon as the tube is infected and would continue throughout the course of active tubal infection. In this scenario, programs should focus on preventing new infections and shortening existing infections as much as possible. If, on the other hand, adaptive T-cell responses primarily drive pathology, damage would mainly occur later in the course of an initial infection after meaningful adaptive responses have developed, and could be substantially enhanced with repeat infection if the infection reaches the tubes. And I think that's an important point to consider, even with small amounts of chlamydial antigen reaching the tubes. In this case, programs could focus on long-standing infection, but would need to pay particular attention to preventing repeat infection. So now let's go to the other side of the equation, some of the things that contribute to potential harms, the role of protective immunity, and harms from repeat infection. So how important is immunity? We know that there doesn't appear to be any evidence for complete immunity, but partial protective immunity, where you have a decrease in the length or the burden of infection on a repeat infection, might affect transmission and detection of infections in the population. That is, shorter duration of infection, you have less chance to transmit it and less chance to detect it. But what we really care about is pathology. A stronger protective immune response could shorten the duration of a repeat infection and might limit infection to the cervix, and therefore you wouldn't get any pathology in the tubes. However, it could theoretically cause more immunopathology if the infection reaches the tubes. A weaker protective immune response could allow longer infection at the cervix or in the tubes and might more readily allow ascension to the tubes, but could cause less immunopathology upon tubal infection. So when we think about how important immunity is and how important potentially arresting immunity with our control programs is, we really need to consider how harmful is repeat infection. And, you know, a lot of the early animal studies found that tubal damage was markedly enhanced with repeat infection. And This was widely interpreted as meaning that repeat infections are inherently more dangerous than initial infections. And I think this is one of the things that I learned through this process. This is one of my preconceived notions that I think was changed slightly by looking at the data more closely, that there were a lot of limitations to those models. And Dr. Darville mentioned one of them. One of the main things is that in some of the studies, there was direct inoculation of the tubes or in tubal tissue that was grafted onto the abdominal wall. And in this case, damaging cells could go right to the tubes and damage that tissue instead of going to the cervix, where that strong response could actually stop the infection from ascending and actually be protective. So when you look at the epidemiologic data, it is definitely clear that two infections are greater risk for sequelae than one infection. And the more infections, the more risk. But it's not clear that the risk per infection increases, that a repeat infection is more damaging. In all of these studies, the duration of infections was unknown. And the repeat infections may just be a reflection of a longer cumulative duration of infection. For programs that are trying to balance how important treating a persistent infection is versus potentially preventing or leaving a woman open to a new repeat infection, the most important key question is, are two infections of 6 months duration greater risk than one infection of 12 months duration? And we still don't know the answer to that. So, in summary, we have not yet determined the precise mechanisms and degree to which chlamydial infections resolve or persist, cause pathology, or stimulate immunity to reinfection. A better understanding of Chlamydia trachomatis immunobiology would have important implications for the effectiveness, cost-effectiveness, and optimal structure of chlamydia control programs, and also for development of an effective chlamydia vaccine. And I'd like to talk a little bit more about the optimal structure of programs. You know, we've seen when Dr. Berman presented the data about screening, that screening has benefit for an individual woman, even with the limitations to those studies. But it doesn't mean that if we knew more about natural history, we could structure our programs in a way to maximize that benefit. So, for example, a better understanding of the mechanisms and timing of pathogenesis could tell us whether our primary focus should be on treating long-standing prevalent infection or reducing incidence of new infections in the population. A program that's primarily focused on reducing incidence of new infections might put much more effort into finding and treating sex partners rather than just finding prevalent infections wherever we find them. Getting a better understanding of the importance of persistent versus repeat infection in determining pathology would allow us to understand what's the best resource allocation for primary screening versus prevention and treatment of repeat infections. And a better understanding of the duration of infection and timing of tubal damage could also help to determine the optimal frequency of screening and of rescreening. And finally, determination of specific cellular and cytokine responses that predict sequelae or that predict susceptibility to repeat infection could allow us could allow biomarkers that could allow targeting of control efforts. So through this process, we've looked at a number of research needs that are important, and these research needs fall in three main areas: translational studies, prospective human studies, and diagnostic tools and biomarkers. So what I mean by translational studies is research that looks at how immune mechanisms found in animal and in vitro studies play a role in humans. And also, conversely, thinking about how animal models can be made to more closely parallel the human situation. So there are a lot of translational studies that would be important, and I've just put two examples here. First, the flow cytometry studies that Dr. Darville talked about, if we can get a better understanding of the cell types and the kinetics of the cellular response, both in animals and in humans from whom we have clear clinical histories, we might gain a better understanding of the nature and timing of damaging immune responses and the factors to be explored prospectively in prospective studies, which I'll talk about in a second. Evidence for the aberrant RB state in vivo, perhaps using techniques such as electron microscopy on human biopsy specimens, would allow us, would have important implications for our ability to detect potentially important chronic infections, and also the efficacy of current treatment, which some of you brought up. We desperately need better prospective human data to give insight into the duration of infection, the risk and timing of chlamydial ascension to the upper tract, the risk and timing of tubal damage, and development of protective immunity. We also need these studies to figure out which immune responses are most predictive of these outcomes. Now, clearly, given all the limitations, these types of studies will be difficult, but I think that they're important, and if they're carefully planned with vigorous attention to ethical standards, they can be done in some fashion and should be a priority. Study designs may take advantage of the interval between testing and treatment, as several people have discussed. Existing cohorts and trials, you know, some of the studies that have provided information from us have looked at serial specimens that were collected for natural history studies for other infections, HIV, HPV, and HPV prevention trials, all of these things in which specimens are collected beyond those just used for standard of care testing for chlamydia. So I think we should at least think about and explore opportunities for collaborating and using those types of specimens. In addition, frequent non-invasive sampling to determine timing of acquisition of infection may also be a strategy that can be used in these studies. I've given a few examples of prospective human studies here. For example, studies that look at immune responses at a given point of time and their association with risk could give us clues to the overall risk and timing of sequelae, and also could provide markers for targeted control efforts for those at highest risk. Studies of partial immunity, looking at immune responses at time one in someone who's had an infection, whether that those predict incidence of repeat infection, could allow us to find markers to target control efforts, and would also allow us to model transmission dynamics in the setting of our control programs, and would also have important implications for development of a chlamydia vaccine. Comparative screening trials under certain circumstances could be helpful. For example, comparing different frequencies of screening, not only could this refine the benefits of screening in different populations, but could also shed light on the natural history and timing of sequelae. For example, comparing sequelae that occur in different intervals between the two arms. And finally, we need better diagnostic tools and biomarkers. Accurate, non-invasive measures of tubal damage and biomarkers of duration and exposure are important. We've long been hindered by the really inaccurate measurement that we have. PID is notoriously inaccurate clinical diagnosis, and to look for actual salpingitis requires invasive technology. So non-invasive measures should be explored. Several of these have been explored before, for example, MRI or power Doppler for looking at tubal inflammation. There are things that have been evaluated, and these would be really important to allow all of these studies of natural history and also trials of control strategies and surveillance of outcomes. Finally, biomarkers of duration of infection or exposure could allow us to do studies of risk in a much more feasible fashion. And so I just want to end on a note to say that in doing this and realizing some of these research needs, collaboration is essential. And laboratory basic scientists, clinical researchers, epidemiologists, and program scientists really need to think about this and how we can have active exploration of opportunities to collaborate to answer these key questions for control programs. And speaking of collaboration, I'd like to acknowledge the many people who attended the 2008 Chlamydia Immunology and Control Expert Advisory Meeting and participated in the upcoming special issue of JID that will be coming out in a few months, looking at these issues in detail. And I'd especially like to thank Fuji Zoo, David Martin, Bob Brunham, and Jerry Byrne for their help with this. Thanks very much. And so I'd like to open up for questions, not just on this talk, but for all the speakers. Wait, I'm sorry, I didn't hear the last part. Yeah. Yeah, the question was about the importance of genotyping to be used to differentiate persistent from new infection, and that's actually a really important thing that I think when we think about these diagnostic tools and biomarkers, one of the really important things is to incorporate genotyping to distinguish persistent infection from repeat infection, and some of the studies that Will was talking about and Byron just done a study using this, so go ahead.
All right, Will may have something to add. He probably will have something to add. We had just done a study of repeat infections and found that about 55 or so percent of the repeat infections were due to a different genotype. So in our mind, that clearly distinguished these as reinfections. The problem is that 45% of them were with an indistinguishable genotype based on the methods that we were using, and actually found that behavioral information was important in distinguishing those. It may be that future technologies using multi-locus strain typing will help distinguish some of these, but I think that people who are in a relationship and one gets infected and the gets treated, the other does not, and that these types of same genotype reinfections are relatively common. But it is helpful, but it is not the answer in distinguishing repeat infection from a persistent infection or treatment failure.
Right. Basically, to repeat the comment question, it's about repeat infection. In addition to when we're screening for repeat infection, there are two reasons to do that. One reason is that we want to get rid of any harm from repeat infection, especially if repeat infection might be more harmful than an ongoing initial infection. But in addition, we know that the risk of the prevalence is high in that group. So if you're trying to target screening efforts towards people who have a high chance of having chlamydial infection, people with one infection are likely to have another one. So I think it can be thought of in two different ways. And our recommendation is to re-screen people in 3 months, and we think that's an important thing. But I think in terms of thinking about the whole program, in terms of how you might think about allocating resources to that activity, like how much do you push on finding reinfections versus just increasing screening coverage across broader population, some of these some of this information on natural history could affect that balance. But I agree that, you know, people with one infection are more likely to have another infection. They're higher risk. And so we need to think about using them in terms of targeted screening strategies. Yes. Mm-hmm. So the question is related to couples in which a woman is found to have chlamydial infection and then the partner goes to get tested and is not found to have the infection. And there are multiple possible explanations. And, I mean, Will has done some work looking at clearance in according to gender, if you want to... Yeah.
Well, I'll just give you the quick answer, which is really just have to treat the partner. I think there's... I mean, that's the... Right. I mean... And because, right, yeah, I mean, because for those who, you know, work in the clinical setting, we all know that basically there's a lot of finger pointing that goes on. The partner would say, well, I didn't give you chlamydia because my test is negative. So, you know, either that partner had chlamydia and resolved it already, okay, but because we heard about protective immunity, that partner's not fully protected, so that partner can get the infection again. So if you treat only the patient, I mean, perhaps they're having sex again, maybe give it back to the partner. You know, so you really just don't know. I mean, there's no way to know who gave it to who and whether they can get it or not. And our general approach is, if this is a partner especially, you've been with them the last 60 days, then just treat the partner, treat the patient both. Neither of them starts having sex again until they've both completed their treatment. But I try to take the finger pointing out of the equation and to say that, you know, we don't know if you had it, when you had it, if you cleared it or not. We just know that you both need to get treated for it. And that's the approach I've taken on the clinical standpoint. Yeah, I don't think it's really the number of partners is not the issue. It really is how far back it is. I think, you know, we've often said 60 days, but in all honesty, I mean, we really don't know how accurate that is either. But I think from a practical standpoint, clearly, you know, within 60 days, I think that's right now the CDC's recommendations. Yeah.
And one thing to just bring up about that in terms of discordant partners, one of the things that Byron brought up briefly was couple studies, and that's one of the things that can be done to kind of think about factors predicting protective immunity and studying that. And so I think that's a really important research need, too, is to look at dyads and see, you know, what predicts one partner having an infection and the other partner in whom you've had, like, a well-defined sexual history not having it. And so I think that's another important thing that could shed some light on it.
I mean, test, you know, and then the other thing is test sensitivity is not 100%. If you're screening men with urine, maybe that male has peed within the last 1 hour. That test could be negative anyway. He could have it in the epididymis and not in the urethra. I think you just have to treat the male or the partner. You just don't know that.
Yeah, and so the question was about this primarily being focused on women, and I'd like to say that when we set up this meeting and thought about the key questions, we really, because there was so much information and there were so many questions, we really limited because the primary goal was reduction of reproductive sequelae in women, we really limited information to women, you know, by design, just because there was too much. But I agree that it's an important thing, and we need to think about men in different ways, not just what happens in men, and I think Will has some thoughts about that too, but also how we structure our programs based on these natural history findings in terms of how much we focus on men in our program efforts.
Yeah. And just quick, because there are other questions, just I would refer you to the CC website. There was a male chlamydia screening guidelines, actually, and there's a document kind of, you know, looking at all that literature, because the big question from a program standpoint is, if we only have X limited resources and we're not even getting all the women screened, should we spend the rest of the resources, you know, trying to screen more women than actually screen men, because women have more morbidity? But I would refer you to that CDC document. I think first in the back, she's really been raising her hand in the pink here, trying to get her voice heard there. I can comment on that. I'm doing a lot of work in that area right now. So, you know, we clearly know that humans make both mucosal and systemic antibody. And actually, I'm doing some work right now that has not been published. But we pretty much find that, you know, most humans who are, you know, infected with chlamydia do make systemic antibodies. I mean, you can measure, for instance, IgG. What's interesting is, you know, we were talking earlier about some of these individuals who, quote, resolve their infection. And so in my cohort, we've looked at some people who we would have said, you know, they've resolved their infection. But it turns out that, you know, at the time they, quote, resolved their infection, they have no antibody. And then we bring them back 6 months later in my cohort, we find they still have no antibody. So are they resolving their infection and actually they were never infected? Because we had such sensitive NATs, we're measuring chlamydia in the vagina from the male, and when they come back and we retest them, we don't measure it at that point. Or are some of these people never mounting response because we're treating them so early in infection, we're aborting the, you know, the antibody response? I mean, I don't know, except that clearly not everybody who we test, who tests positive for chlamydia, have chlamydia antibodies, and some were probably never infected, and some just never mounted an antibody response. But what we don't know yet is, again, how that leads to, quote, correlation from protection. That we don't know, like we might know for other infections. We don't know if having antibodies or a specific titer, or at least to my knowledge, and you can add, we don't know if that's, quote, protective for infection. We're going to try to look at that in some of my cohort data, but we just don't know that yet. Well, it's just not accurate. I mean, I think you just nailed it right there. We just don't, I mean, what we are going to have in my cohort is we do have a six-month follow-up visit in this cohort that I have right now. So at least between the time that I'm studying them at baseline, 6 months, if they acquire infection in the interval, we'll at least have somewhat of an idea then. But outside of that, really it's difficult. It's very, very difficult. I mean, actually, Byron's done one of the few studies where they've basically done these vaginal swabs on a weekly basis in women, bringing it back every 3 months. And, you know, they kind of know in women at least have positive tests. Presumably some of those are true infections. But, I mean, you know, unless you do a study where you don't treat people and you watch them over time, you're not going to know that. And obviously you can understand that the ethical challenges in doing that and even trying to get that type of study approved by an IRB is just about impossible.
And I just wanted to mention, too, we do have a study that's going on right now where we're using stored specimens from a longitudinal trial of HIV incidence in African women, and looking at, they had serial testing for chlamydia every 3 months for a couple of years, and looking at it in, according to when they acquired a new infection, all these things, looking at serologic tests to look at the time, how many women seroconvert, the time course of seroconversion, the titers associated, and whether that's associated, whether they also got PID. So we do have some information that will be coming in on that. And I think having a marker of cumulative, you know, when we talk about cumulative duration of infection, we know that kind of the prevalence of antibodies and the titers of antibodies are higher in women with more severe sequelae. That could have been from longer duration of infection or repeated infections. And so having a marker that specifically tells you how long someone has had an infection could really be helpful.
And I was just going to say, the other thing about the cohort I'm following right now is that we can show that at 6 months, their antibody titers are actually very stable. So from the time that we treat them and then a six-month follow-up visit, their titers are very stable, but some of those individuals are getting repeat infections, and when we serotype their strains, it's the same serotype again. So they don't really have protection from that specific strain, and their antibody titers haven't changed. Now, we've taken some T cells from some of these subjects and stimulated them in the laboratory, and the T cell responses do differ at 6 months. So I would argue that, you know, the antibody is probably not a good kind of quote protective measure to look at. Yeah. Yeah. My gut feeling is that antibody is not going to be a good study in humans to determine when they've had infection and things like protection. The T cell responses are going to be much better for that. We've had actually this gentleman, I think, up here had a question before. Yeah. Oh.
The what?
And where is this that the men are? Where? Okay, yeah. Because I guess I didn't see the movie last night, but I think I got the impression that attitudes in men, perhaps in the U.S. and other countries, could be quite different. So even though the uptake of screening may be good in one country, for instance, it may not be so great in others. So, but I mean, obviously, I think most of us in the field would like to be screening men on a routine basis. I think it's really just a program issue about the resources to be able to do that. And if you do target screening, who do you target? I think those are the questions we ask. I think actually she had the... Well, he kind of did this study, at least in coming back, about 3 weeks. But well, the question is, so a woman comes in, she gets treated for chlamydia, then she brings her partner back a week later, basically. They've had sex in, you know, within that 1 week period, and the question is, could she get infected again? Well, she's exposed again, certainly. And, you know, she may have some partial immunity, as was shown earlier, but we don't know. I mean, my general conservative approach has been to treat her again. And I don't know, would you comment on that anymore? Now, you don't need to test them is one issue, okay, because I mean, the DNA-based test still being paused. I think you just treat them, basically. That's what I would do. Yeah. If there's an inoculant sitting in the vagina with chlamydia, I would just treat them again, I think. You know.
But I also think you bring up an important issue is the importance of efforts to find and treat sex partners. And I think that's something that's come up over and over again, that we really need to improve that with things like expedited partner therapy. So those issues are really important when you think about how you might try to reduce transmission in a population, especially in the setting where right now we do only recommend screening of women, that really partner treatment efforts are important.
Yeah, I mean, right. I mean, that's so. Are you willing to bank on the pharmacokinetics of the drug that'll be cured? And I'm not. I mean, you know, the cost of the drug versus the chance she gets infected again. I mean, I don't consider that. I mean, personally, because how do you know? You know.
Yeah.
You know, because, you know, chlamydia can survive, maybe even a barely. So you've been wanting to ask, you know, I asked a question down here for a long time, so you had a question. Yeah, so, I mean, I guess trying to repeat the question, I think, it, you know, gets at about the timing of treatment again based on when they're tested again, and you were kind of hinting at what point maybe it's still just a false positive test. So, you know, we have these nucleic acid amplification tests. They're very sensitive. I just reviewed this literature because I developed a treatment trial for a company, and it turns out that basically in the small number of studies published, most of the time between about 14 to 21 days after treatment, most of the chlamydia infections are going to be gone and the test is not going to be negative. We assume that if you test somebody 28 days from the time that you start treatment, that they should have essentially all the persisting dead DNA should have been cleared. So somebody who comes back a month or more later and they have a positive test, I think right now we are assuming that that's a new infection. It's not a false positive residual infection and they've just been reinfected by a partner. And we would treat them again at that point. I'm actually going to be doing a study here in the next 2 years, I think it is. We're going to look at this clearance of DNA issue following treatment with some of these different NETs. No. Actually, I just addressed this with the FDA for this treatment trial because they have the same thing. Because if you look in the package insert about using chlamydia, you know, the chlamydia NETs say they're not to be used for a test to cure, because they're highly sensitive in their DNA-based test. And that culture has been, quote, the standard for test to cure. The problem is culture, the sensitivity of that test is anywhere from maybe 50 to 80% depending upon the laboratory doing it, and there's not a lot of laboratories that can actually do it. The newer NAT sensitivity is over 90%. And so I would not feel comfortable if a chlamydia culture is my test to cure and it's negative that they're actually cured. And so in the CDC guidelines now, you know, I wrote the 2006 chlamydia section in the upcoming 2010. We recommend NAT as the test for test to cure, at least in pregnant women, which is the only population that we recommend a test to cure at the current time. Or 3 weeks after treatment is what we're recommending based on the...
For pregnant women.
Oh, for pregnant women, 3 weeks after completion of treatment, or 28 days after the start of treatment, if you want to think of it that way.
Okay, well, I think we should conclude. Thank you, everyone, and we'll be up here if you have any more questions.